Marty wanted to know what he could say about me. I said, I get embarrassed when people compliment me. I'm like Mark Twain, I'm embarrassed because I think they're not saying enough. So I don't want him to say anything. My name is Ajit. God, a Mensa crowd. They say only people with high intelligence can pronounce foreign names. I want to thank you all for asking me to come out. I want to thank Linda for starting the process, and then Norma for following up, and Marty. I think Peggy wasn't kidding about Marty in the airport, because when I landed, there was no one at the airport. And normally, Anilons are pretty anal about coming to the airport to pick up the speaker, so to speak. I get 3 intercom things from the pilot saying they want to know if you're on the flight. So I was a bit surprised when there was no one at the airport. Now I know why. He saw airport left and he left. And then he saw a sign that says airport return, so he came back. Thank you, Marty, for picking me up. And then Pat's been a terrific host, taking me around, showing me a wonderful town, Jekyll Island, and St. Simon's and Sea Island. Thank you, Mary Lou, for leaving him to be with me. Thanks. God, I do want to welcome the Al-Anons. Hello. It's good to have you. Any AAs in the crowd, welcome. For those who are real naughty. Are there any dual members? You know, you get the boat. Must be fun to be a dual member. You probably elbow yourself at every meeting. Get bruised up. God. My name is Indian, not the feathered kind, but the turban kind. I have worn neither. There are no stereotypes about me. I don't nod my head from side to side when I talk to you. I don't own a 7-Eleven. Or a gas station, no. The spikes on my golf shoes are on the outside. All the stereotypes are covering everything here. I'll tell you why. I was asked to speak in Kentucky many years ago. I get off the flight, and my host is there. I said, who's speaking tonight? That's Friday night. He said, oh, it's Chink. I said, oh my God, he's going to call me a raghead any moment now. So I show up to the speaker meeting, and there's this lady, Chink. She's about 4 foot nothing from Oklahoma. One dark lens, one light. So I figured he wasn't being racist. He was just mentioning a name, which is rather odd. But then what's odd, Ajit? I can tell you in a moment what my problem is. My problem essentially is twofold. I can't recall exactly when I came into Al-Anon. It was circa 1980. But I can tell you to the moment when she, now my former spouse, came into AA. May 25th, 1983, 8:02 p.m. And I tell you, thank you. Thanks to my God, my sponsor, and the big book of Al-Anon, I have not had the need to take an obsessive thought or control anyone for the last 24 years. So I never take a birthday cake because I slip all the time, I tell you. My other problem is image management. And that's been the bane of my existence for the longest time. That's what essentially brought me into Al-Anon. Image management is this. I may feel like crap, but I got to look good because you're judging me. And you judge me even more so by the company I may keep. This came in my childhood. My mom used to walk around saying, what would they say? I had no idea who those they were that had no lives because they were focusing on me all the time. I like what Dr. Paul had to say. I'm not much, but that's all I think about. I'm not much, but that's all I think. And I think you have done anything else to do but to think about me all the time. And that's what's brought me into this program. I'd like to keep it very, very simple and essentially tell you how it was, what happened, how it is today. I started off, like I said, I left the shores of Bombay, India in 1974 after I'd finished up with high school, graduated from college. I climbed up the proverbial mountain and I asked my guru, I said, oh, great one, I seek serenity. And he said, go to Detroit, Michigan and join Al-Anon. I'll just say that for effect. The bastard neglected to tell me I had to marry an alcoholic in the process. Serenity now. I left the shores of Bombay, warned by well-meaning friends and family, and they said, do not get involved with an American woman. Women from Georgia, okay. And I said, why not? They said, oh, they drink and smoke and women like men do. Translation, Indian women do it behind closed doors. They're discreet about it. Now, I did not particularly care about the fact that the American woman smoked, but I loved the fact that she drank, because they say candy's dandy and liquor's quicker. It made my progress in an evening extremely cost-effective and expedient. I was like the Alan Alda character in MASH, my kind of woman, drunk. Little did I know that that would bring me to Al-Anon. And then I'd want the woman to stop drinking. What a shame. See, I had no knowledge of this disease. At least that's what I thought. This is despite the fact that we lost an uncle in India to this crazy disease. He died of the cirrhosis of liver. He died blind in both eyes. He was literally dropped off an almost stopped car by his wife outside another uncle's door. I thought she was practicing the art of detachment, but she was actually indulging in geographic distancing, out of sight, out of mind. And my headmaster in school, you call them vice principals, he had started the first chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous in Bombay, India. And I asked a friend of mine, I said, what is Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, oh, they get drunks off the street and get them sober. Little did I know, at least figuratively, that AA would come to now. My ex-wife, I'm asked not to call her my ex-wife, but my former spouse. So for the sake of abbreviation, we'll call her FS, so you know what I'm talking about. And thanks to AA, she's been sober now 24 odd years. I haven't counted the hours and moments yet, but I'm recovering myself. I'm getting healthier. So I come out to the States and I, you know, finish up with my graduate work, and I'm working for Xerox, and I hang around the watering holes of suburban Detroit, Southfield, Michigan. There was a little watering hole called Yesterday's, and I would lure my next target, if you will, to an adventure, which is like going to downtown Detroit, and they loved it because no one wanted to go to downtown Detroit, except we'd go to a place called Greektown, and Greektown was policed by the Greek mafia. So you were in trouble if you owed someone money, but you were not going to get mugged. No one stole money from you. So anyway, the reason I like Greektown is because you could get a four-course meal back in the 70s for like 25, 30 bucks. And that full-course meal for two included something called Roditas wine. And Roditas wine had this magnificent quality of transforming an absolute stranger into the best of friends over the course of a meal. And I loved it. I told my wife when we married, I said, you know, we Al-Anons carry a little beam in our head. Alcoholic, don't waste your time. Alcoholic, don't waste your time. Move on. No, not alcohol, move on, move on, move on. If she's not an alcoholic, move on. And the moment my beam stuck with yours, you're the alcoholic. All those other relationships I had, I said, I could have married any of them, but no, I married you because the beam took off. And see, to use the word relationship is insulting the word, for me at least, because mine was like a week and a half, maybe a month long. So we're barely getting to know someone, but we're calling it a relationship. And I said, and I met you, my beam took off, and your beam took off, and here we are. She said, you're an idiot. If you'd married one of them, you would have driven them to drink too, like you did me. So. She was not being responsible for her own actions now. That's how I talked to that poor woman when she drank. Sue, I am angry. And she said, who are you, some stuffed shirt, Prince Charles? Why don't you say, scream like we Polish people do. She happened to be Polish. That's why you left the air, one or two. Oh, God. It happened because of image man. Now, the first part of my story, I got to tell you, is a story of a prick. Pardon the expression. I'm recovering now. I'm less so today. So if you, especially the women folk, if you get a little mad, just remember that was the old days when I was really, really sick. Today I'm much healthier and I don't act that way. But image management came to the reason why I met my spouse. I was dating someone. I said, dating, we're going out. And I was invited to my boss's house for a party. And I did not want to take this woman to the party because she did not meet the image I wanted to project at this party. See, that sounds like a real cad, doesn't it? It does. I would say that for myself. So I'm here at this watering hole at Wayne State called TJ's, and here's my princess working her way through nursing school as a waitress at this place. And she comes to wait at our table, and her beam takes off, my beam takes off, and I ask her out to go with me to this party. And she made me feel really proud. She said, you know, I've never, ever gone out with any patron. Lucky guys, I was here. Out the short straw. So I'll go out with you. So I invited her to dinner before the party, And my God has a sense of humor like you wouldn't believe. He sends signals galore in a funny sort of way. Normally, when I went out to dinner with a woman, I listened with an open mind, in one ear, out the other, because I'm strategizing. The guys know what I'm talking about. But with this woman, I was actually indulging in intellectual intercourse. We were actually having a conversation. I was listening to what she was saying over a three-hour dinner, and it was scary. I should have left at the restaurant and driven away, but no, I was going to find my serenity, even if it killed me, which it almost did a few times. So I show up at my party with my new lady, and my buddy George walks up to me and he says, "So, how long have you known Susan?" I said, "Just met last week." He said, "Nah, you look like you've been together 7-8 years. You look very comfortable together." If you look very comfortable with someone on your first date, it simply means that the rocks in your head fit the holes in hers, or vice versa. Leave. We proceed, oh, past life stuff maybe, we're soulmates. So we started to see each other. And about 3 months later into our relationship, knock, knock, knock on a Wednesday evening or so at 10 o'clock at my apartment door. I opened the door and here stands Sue staring at me with a lump on her head. And I said, "What happened?" She said, "My mother struck me in an alcoholic rage." And the child, the knight in me, and the father in me, the parent in me, the caretaker in me, I mean, personalities that Sybil and Roseanne would have probably fought over came gushing forth. And I said, "You will not move in with that woman, you will move in with me." Now, a Hindu from Bombay, India does not ask a Polish Catholic girl to move in with him. But see, that wasn't the scary part. The scary part was watching her God-fearing, very Catholic mother, who disavowed sinful living together arrangements, actually helping her daughter move in with me. So that should have been a real clue. Something is not right here. So we moved in together, and it was hunky-dory for a while, you know, the first blush of romance, and everything's wonderful. And then strange things are starting to happen. Strange noises coming out of the bedroom, and I'm not even there. Fights happening for no apparent reason. And you know, you'd say that maybe I was in denial, but denial is progress for me. I was in a state of total cluelessness. And today, in retrospect, I know why. Because I had no depth to my personality. I had no sense of feeling. I didn't know the meaning of the word feeling. For the first time I heard feelings was in my men's stag group from men. And one day, this is how disconnected I was. When I'm sitting in my men's stag group and guys are talking about feelings, on the way home, I'm sipping on a soda and I start to feel a filling in my chest. And I said, "Oh my God, I'm experiencing a feeling. But I'm not happy, happy, and I'm not sad, sad. What is this feeling?" And all of a sudden, carbon dioxide escapes me and the feeling is gone. That's how disconnected this person was with this. How the hell am I going to connect with someone at an emotional level? No idea. And I think retrospectively, there was a bit of a sociopath in me. In other words, if she was of some use to me, fantastic. If not, I didn't care. And I didn't know that. See, I feigned sincerity like you wouldn't believe. And I wasn't even aware of the fact that I wasn't being sincere. I thought I was being sincere, and I was really not being sincere. So anyway, here we are getting into fights and stuff, and I don't know what's going on. So we decided to do the next best thing. We decided to get married. If all else fails, get married. Get married, and we move into this little condo, which brought me into a place of denial and onto awareness and acceptance. This condo had a little half bathroom that played a pivotal role in my coming out of my delusions, if you will. This is how silly and crazy I was. You know, the alcoholic is really not the problem. They're not the problem. It's how I react to the person's behavior. Because you take the alcoholic away, you put a guy in front of me doing 60 in a speed zone of 70, I'm going nuts. Okay, it's not the alcoholic. People ask me, is alcoholism a disease? I said, I really don't know and I don't care. That's not the subject of my discussion. My problem is my response to other people's behavior. Whether it's drinking, eating, smoking, flying, whatever it is, if it's behavior, I tend to obsess on it, and that's my problem. I'm like a food addict. I need to learn how to respond to people responsibly. I can't jump in and run their lives as if they're idiots and they have no sense on how to run their lives, and I need to get in there. So here we are. I go in a stupid bathroom. I opened the cabinet door, 6 or 7 empty cans of beer would topple out. This anal retentive moron would go up to his wife and say, "What were those empty cans doing outside the trash can?" I'm not questioning why 6 empty cans are doing in the bathroom cabinet. And she'd say, "Aunt Bunny came over and had a few beers." It never occurred to me to call Aunt Bunny and say, "Why do you take a 6-pack into my bathroom?" I mean, are we eliminating the middleman? I don't know. And this has puzzled me for the longest time. My buddy shows up. I said, would you like a glass of wine? Sure. So I reach in the cabinet, pull out a bottle of wine. I swear to you, the bottle has a cork in it. It has the wrapper and the seal around it, but the bloody thing is empty. Is there a store that caters to alcoholics to sell them long syringes saying, suck the drink out and mess with the other person's mind, saying, what happened here? It wasn't, again, image management came to the rescue. My folks had moved in into the area, and I was going to introduce my white sheep of the family, if you will. They'd warned me. So I take my wife to meet my family, and she's obviously had one too many that I don't know about because I'm really not into her. And I smell some mouthwash and stuff, and we get into a fight, which, you know, she wasn't a happy drunk. She was a mean drunk. And I don't know where she got her strength. You know, like Popeye eating spinach, booze gave her strength. She could toss stuff across the room. From here to there, she could do it about 90 miles an hour. Lampshades, dishes, flies, whatever. So I got in this fight, and I said, I can't take you to meet my family in this condition. I'm going to take you back. So she jumps out of the car and rushes into her bar, this little half bathroom. And I walk by. She thought, why is your bathroom becoming a bar? I had no idea. Oh, it was convenient. You know, eat, drink, throw up, it's all the same, sir. So she's trying to jam shut the door to this cabinet, and they say it's a disease of perceptions because it gets so convoluted. I thought I saw in there was a 55-gallon drum of Gallo wine. It was like a 1-gallon jug. And it's as if time stood still. I just stood there dumbstruck, and God knows it was an eternity, and a voice in my head said, your wife's an alcoholic, your wife's an alcoholic, your wife's... I mean, all the cluelessness, the denial, all the stuff just washed away for a second there. And if God had materialized in some anthropomorphic form that I could have recognized and talked with and said, you know, we don't need one of you. You're going to think her thoughts, feel her feelings, experience her emotions. You're going to have conversations with her. She's going to respond. It's all going to happen in your head. She doesn't even need to be there. I'd have said, God, you're an idiot. Get out of here. It's never going to happen to me. And that's exactly what happened for the next 3.5 years. I mean, how sick can you get when someone walks by you, because she was a periodic drunk, when someone walks by you, the way they're breathing, you can tell what's going to happen that day. You can tell their mood by the way they say hello over the phone. Good morning, you call from the office. How are you doing? Hello. Oh, God, she's going to get drunk today. And then the mind takes over. And that's it. 3.5 years, the insanity started to happen. As I stood there at that bathroom door, the next thought occurred to me, which is a nasty, nasty thought. It's a thought called logic. And you women have foisted that illusion upon us. We're not very logical as a species, the male kind, as if you will. We tend to be more emotional, except we don't even know it. This is what a PhD in sociology told me. So I got the logic. I said, she's got a drinking problem, and I'll take care of it. How many of us Al-Anons have said that? I'll take care of it. So I'd been watching these Schick Schadl commercials. Do you remember those from TV days? The wife goes up to her husband. She says, sweetheart, you got a drinking problem. Says, darling, you're so right. And they go get treated. Have you heard the aversion therapy thing? So I believed in truth in advertising. I'm a newcomer to the country. So so I walk up to my wife. Said, darling, you have a drinking problem. She said, you're an idiot. I don't. I don't have plan B in place. And this is plan B. Any newcomers in Al-Anon still living with active alcoholism, God bless you. But if you have a lot of time and not much of a life, you may want to try doing these things. They're not going to produce any change, but it's fun. Because the logic in my head said, if I catch her in the act, then she'll know, I'll know, and she'll stop. So I'd sit on the couch, staring at a blank TV set because I don't want it to be on because I need to catch the reflection of what's going on in the kitchen. I'm pretending to do the crossword puzzle, staring at this thing, and I'd see her pour drinks in her glass, in a scotch or whatever she was drinking, and I'd go, aha, like I've discovered a new law in physics or something. Then she'd get up and crawl with some semblance of dignity. She held her nose high as she went up to the bedroom to sleep. I'd get up and I moved the booze around, thinking that when she gets up with the 2 o'clock feed time, she'll know that I'll know. So at 2 o'clock when it came to feed time, I'd be awake. This is insane. I don't have a drinking problem, but I'm crazier than this woman. At least she had an excuse. Oh, God. If I could take that time back and do something productive, I'd be a very wealthy man today. So at 2 o'clock, I hear this clink, clank, clank. Aha, now she knows. I didn't realize that alcoholics have their stash in about 19,000 different places, just in case. You know, actually, I think I was more creative in looking for bottles than that. She wasn't hiding them. I was almost arrested for molesting my vacuum cleaner. Just grabbing at it, looking for, I mean, in the vacuum bag, for God's sake. So I walk up to my wife and said, you know, you realize he wants nudging there. You've done it. I walk up to my wife and said, you know, you really have a drinking problem. She said, no, I don't. We have a marriage problem. I'm Polish Catholic and you're not. I said, what an observation. I would never have come to that conclusion. I'll find a marriage counselor. So I called the marriage counselor and I coached this guy for 30 minutes. I said, I'm going to bring this woman in. You take one look at her and tell her she's an alcoholic, shackle her to your bedpost, and pour stuff down her gullet to get her sober. I didn't know the meaning of the word sobriety. All I wanted was this woman to drink up to two glasses, of white wine only, specifically Chardonnay. Control with an onion. See, because after two drinks, she made an ass of herself, which embarrassed me. That was my problem. I didn't want to be embarrassed because people looked at me and said, oh, what an idiot, he's with this drunk. See, that they really did not do that. I'd go to dinner with my friends and I'd look at Sue and my friend said, Ajit, what's your problem? I said, what's my problem? She's got mozzarella dripping down her chin. She's got pepperoni stuck in her eyebrows. And you're asking me what my problem is. She said, oh, she's having a great time. Chill up. I said, what? You know, they have a t-shirt for alcoholics that say, I drink, I get drunk, I pass out, no problems. This idiot walks and he sees his wife passed out on the floor, stuff coming out of her mouth that tells you she's drunk. Well, what do? I jump over her body and I go to the trash can to critique her choice of alcohol. She had a bottle of red wine with a screw top. Oh, gosh, she didn't let it breathe. I'm being a snob while my Kmart champagne. Who drinks Kmart champagne? And I'm critiquing this. I walked up to my sponsor. I said, oh, my God, I used to be a garbologist. And he said, that's nothing. They always send sponsors to one-upmanship school. If you've been an idiot, they're a bigger idiot because they'll tell you how big an idiot they are. He says, oh, I used to work in the army and I used to fix jeeps in the dark with a flashlight in my mouth. And he said, that trait came in handy because I could go through two garbage cans in the dark. He was very proud of it. I didn't have the heart to tell the poor man he could go to a Granger's industrial supply store and buy a miner's helmet. So if you have this penchant for going through garbage cans at night, buy a helmet, be good to yourself. So anyway, I show up this marriage counselor with this woman in tow. He takes a look at her and says, so, what's the problem? You know how they say psychologists? Any psychologist in here? So, where do you come up with that tone? So, what's the problem? I said, in my head, and said, you idiot, I trained you for 30 minutes. I said, my wife drinks too much. And he said, oh. And he gives her a lecture for like 30 minutes to make a long story short. She's crying. He's writing notes. He lets her go on an outpatient basis, never to be seen again. She said, I'll find a marriage counselor. We find marriage counselor number two, go rushing in to see him. He's been to school with the first guy. He said, so, what's the problem? I said, my wife drinks too much. He said, so, what's the problem? I thought he had a problem with my accent, so I spoke louder and slower, like he's stupid and deaf. I said, my wife drinks too much. I'm doing charades. And he said, so, what's the problem with that? Meaning, God, you know, what's wrong with that? And I realized when you looked at him, his nose was so red. I swear to God, if you shut the lights off, he could have served as a beacon on a dark ocean right here. He could have guided ships. I looked at my wife. I said, oh, my God, he's one of you. He said, he understands. Of course they understood each other. So marriage counseling didn't work. So I threatened to leave. I said, I am leaving. So I packed up my stuff in my little polka dotted cloth, my stick, and I'm walking by there, Porky Pig, remember? I'm teasing with bags. And she came up to me. She said, if you leave, I will commit suicide. I said, that I want to watch so you don't botch it up. See the anger? I don't care. This woman's telling me she's going to commit suicide. I'm encouraging it. But the truth is, if you're that callous and you don't care, keep walking because intentions do change, as they did in this situation. I follow my wife from the exit door to the kitchen, and her intentions change from suicide to homicide. And there are dishes coming at me at 90 miles an hour, and this image-conscious idiot is dodging them instead of running out the door. Why am I not running out the door? Because I don't want my neighbors to find out that my wife has an alcoholic problem. That brings me to this point. Why do alcoholics get anonymous after they get sober? I mean, If you drank anonymously before you get sober, 90% of us wouldn't need a problem. Go sit in some dark, dank room, get drunk and die. I'm teasing. We care about you. We love you. I did care about her. You know, I didn't want to see this happen. I had no idea what was going on. And I walk, you know, I tried. Then I thought, you know, what the heck? I can't leave. She's got fatal attraction to me. See the ego? I'm going to kill her instead. Now I come from the land of Gandhi, right? Non-violence. You're supposed to starve yourself to death, not kill someone. Starvation was not an option. They said Gandhi would never have freed India if Indian food was like Italian food. Eggplant Parmesan? Oh, come on, British can stay. Who the kick ass? Now, I was reading this English. This is how insane. And the point I'm trying to make to myself and to the newcomers is that the insanity is amazing. I mean, the thoughts that go through my head when I'm involved in a situation that I'm so, pardon the expression, helpless over. Powerlessness was not a question here. I felt totally helpless and I felt totally victimized. My victim mantra or motto was, if only she, if only she, if only she. Like she had been the cause of my entire the ruin in my life. I held her responsible for everything. This woman, who was a wonderful cook, was a wonderful wife in her more somber and sober moments, was a great artist, very bright, intelligent woman. All that disappeared. All I saw was this pathetic drunk in front of me that I had very little regard for and I did not want in my life. Yet I was so obsessed with behavior, I didn't know how to get rid of the situation. So here I am reading this magazine called Argosy. It's written, it's a story by Alfred Hitchcock in which he describes the perfect murder weapon. I see a few people kind of lean forward. You won't get it here, you'll have to go east. It's the icicle. It disappears, you take the icicle. And here I am in Michigan, staring outside my window, the icicle's dangling on the eaves of my roof. And I said, I'm going to take one, I'm going to kill her, I'm going to take her into my basement, dig it up, and put her body and put fresh cement over it. I know nothing about masonry, but details, who cares? Then in this 15 nanosecond moment, a thought occurred to me. Wait a minute, my mother-in-law will show up, and she'll find dust on my wife's car, and she'll call the police, and I did not come to the United States to befriend some guy named Bubba in a Michigan prison. Being traded for cigarettes was not an option. You know, I carried the guilt of this for so long, thinking I was the only one. And you know, there is no uniqueness in this program. You say you met your wife in a submarine at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, some other 80 in the room say, oh, wow, I met mine Pacific Ocean that way. We have something common in here. So I'm sitting in my Friday night meeting, and I was sharing my story, and a lady walked up to me and she said, oh, I'm so glad you shared that story because I've been feeling very guilty about this. And I said, what happened? She said, my husband was passed out on the couch and I was going to snuff him out with a pillow. And I said, why did you not do it? And I thought she would say, it's a heinous thing to do. It's a terrible crime. Instead, she said, oh, they would have found cotton in his nose and they would have not. Alcoholism can kill. So murder was not an option. Finally, I come across the twins, and I'm not referring to the Norwegian, you know, ski team. I'm talking about Dear Abby and Ann Landis. I'm a man of the 80s, or can I say 90s. In Al-Anon, my feminine side is so well developed, now I don't need to date. I take myself out. I can have a conversation with me and actually listen. So anyway, reading Ann Landis, and it says, your mother or father or child or whatever of an alcoholic, go to Al-Anon. So I said, finally, 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 someone's going to show me how to get this woman sober. Perceptions. My perceptions are so bloody off. I come into a room that's as well-lit as this. Beautiful women about as old as I am now. I was in my 20s at the time. What I saw was a dark, dingy, desolate, dank room with six women, average age, deceased. That's all. Six dead women. And I walked up to the deadest of them all. I was very angry. I didn't come slithering through the bottom of the door or anything like that. I strode in and I said, how does this thing work? This woman saw a live nut when she said she knew exactly what it was. She wouldn't even get up to greet me. She pointed me to a distant literature table and she said, go there. There's a pamphlet there called 12 Steps. You pick it up and read it. That's how it works. So I walk up and I'm a pseudo-intellectual. I said 12 steps, meaning step 13, click, click, printer shows a solution to the problem. She gets sober. Now I know what step 13 is. So Well, I see at the top what I thought was an escape clause. It said, these tests have been taken from Alcoholics Anonymous, like someone read here. We change only the last word in the 12th step. We say others instead of alcoholics. I said, okay, some apply to me, some don't. So I took my first step, admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Our lives had become unmanageable. I said, it doesn't apply to me. My life isn't unmanageable. They're called denial right there. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I said, I'm sane, she's insane. I got a job, she doesn't, she's drunk. Move on. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I said, wait a minute, God helps those who help themselves. God gave me a will, why should I give it back to him? If I give it back to him, that would make God an Indian giver. See, I can say that. Step four, took a searching and fearless moral inventory. God, I was qualified for sainthood. Step five, made a list of, you know, defects of character, told myself and someone else. I said, wait a minute, first of all, there's nothing to tell anyone, and that goes against the credo of image management. If there was something wrong with me, I'm not going to tell you about it. And of course, since there was nothing wrong, God did not have to know. So six and seven don't come into play because there's no defects of character to be ready to remove. And step seven had a word that was alien to my vocabulary. It said humbly. Actually, I was so humble, I was proud of it. I moved on to step eight. Made a list of persons I had harmed. They deserved it. Step. This is how my mind is going in this stupid meeting. Nine. Made direct amends. When is she going to make amends to me? She's the one who's harmed me. Step 10. Continue to think. Now my head's hurting because the halo's fitting too tight. I get to step 11. Sought through prayer and meditation. I did not get to the second half. Praying only for the knowledge of his will for me. Step 10, 11 is prayed. I said, God, I pray all the time. Get her killed. The Indian equivalent of 12 Hail Marys. Don't get anyone else killed. That's 24. Forget it. God, just bring her home. Making deals with God. And I'd go home praying every night. God, I hope she's passed out. 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 I get home, she's passed out. Damn it, she's passed out. Now, what do? I get in my car, drive to another watering hole with a stinky cigar. Why? I got an alcoholic at home. Why am I going to shop for another one? I'm not even Mormon. So, I'm not politically correct. Just kidding. So I get to the place. I light up my cigar. Those days you could smoke inside restaurants and bars, so no woman in a 30-mile radius would come close to me, angry at everything, angry at the cigar, angry at the drink, angry at the women, angry at my wife, going home praying, oh God, if she's passed out. What a lousy bloody way to live. And I didn't know it, that the solution was in here. It was not out there. It didn't happen until I started going to that meeting. And that meeting, and I don't proselytize from the stage because I'm no brighter, smarter, or anything like that. There are people who work the program and can stand and talk, and there are people who don't work the program who can stand and talk, and there are people down there who can not stand up and talk in front of people and work a wonderful program. So just because I'm standing here doesn't make me any more wonderful than anyone out there. But this is what was, I go to this meeting, and they tell me, I said, tell me about this alcoholism thing. Is it really a disease? And they said, oh, you can't leave the alcoholic because this disease is like cancer or it's like diabetes. Now, you don't do that to a pseudo-intellectual person and tell them it's a disease like cancer or diabetes. Because what happens when I leave the meeting, this brain now bifurcates into about 19,000 different brains, and each one's having a little committee group conscience on the concept of disease, and there's an argument going on. Is it a disease like cancer? Oh, yeah, then why is she seeking chemotherapy? It's like diabetes. Why is she seeking insulin therapy? This whole emphasis on the physical and physiological definition of disease, which alcoholism, at least to my understanding, is not. And I didn't know that. So here I am fighting over this thing called disease. I'm not thinking about my reactions to what's going on and to what I am doing. Sane people don't go home and look at their wife who's sitting on the couch because she's now having a dry day and look up to her because you're not sure if she's been drinking. You go up and say, honey, how was your day? While you kiss, you suck the breath out of that poor woman. How many of you have done that sniff and kiss? You don't need to drink. You get slap happy doing it. See, someone's getting nudged there. I used to go, and they said, you know, I finished these 12 steps. I look at this big kahuna, and I said, now what? She said, keep coming back. And I said, why? She said, because you're sick. And she said, sick, like she's spitting at me. I said, I'm not sick. The sick one's at home. She said, no, you're sick. You come back. So I did. Every 6 weeks, I'd go back. Now I'm embarking on a program that's going to get to the core of my psyche. It's going to get to that little screw that's going to just oh so slightly turn it to change my beliefs, which is then going to alter my perceptions, that's going to alter my reality, that's going to alter my behavior and finally change who I am becoming and I'm going to do this by going to class every 6 weeks. Just doesn't work that way. And I didn't know it. And the emphasis all the time was on her, not on me, because this arrogant prick thought he was okay. If only she would, I'd be all right. But if I sat back and objectively looked at my resume, I was sicker than she was, because I was not possessed by a demon called alcoholism. And today, I am very grateful that I encountered this disease, because if it hadn't been for this disease, I would have continued on assuming things were going the way. I would have continued on my merry way of arrogance and short-sightedness and total lack in depth and personality. So when I say I'm grateful for the alcoholic in my life, I truly mean. And I have some people saying, oh God, how can you be grateful? It's a gift that she has received because of her disease. She's a changed person, and thanks to the program, I'm a changed person. So anyway, I was transferred to Chicago. I'm going to speed up a little bit and running short on time. So I was in Chicago, and there, and I'm not suggesting you do this at your own Al-Anon meetings, I was chastised in Phoenix, I think it was, for even mentioning it at the podium, but this is my story. I went to my first Al-Anon meeting in Schaumburg, Illinois, and I raised the specter of disease. I said, explain to me how alcoholism is a disease. And a fellow looked at me, he said, if you want to know the definition of this disease, go to the text. And in the Al-Anon meeting, they had the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous at the literature table. So I pick it up and I read the things. I read the first 163 pages, and I read, and for the first time I recognized that this disease transcended the physical and physiological definitions of disease and entered the realms of psychological and spiritual. I mean, people still don't know what causes alcoholism. All we know is that AA works and is doing the best job that any other program. Other people constantly, I listen to talk show radio, and they're constantly trying to deny the fact that the disease, it's a willpower thing. You know, I have not had that problem, but to walk into the bedroom and watch my wife actually hold a nose, because she could not stand scotch. Her choice of alcohol was wine and vodka. To actually hold a nose so she could put scotch down just to stop the shakes told me it went beyond willpower. There was no such thing as willpower involved, because I saw it in my own eyes and I saw it in my own senses. So I couldn't sit there and say, geez, if I can stop, why can't you stop? It just doesn't work that way. So I'm so grateful they gave me that book. I read the book. And I started to work the steps. Now I want to tell you, I came into a program in 1980, but it finally took hold in 1997. Why? Because my problem is my intellect. Because I read something, I think I know it. If I think I know it, I think I've experienced it. There's a big gap between knowing and experience, but I thought I had it all here. So my program was stuck in this, what is this, about 30 odd inches? You men exaggerate. It's about 8 to 10 inches here. It's stuck in here. And I can philosophize on the steps. I can talk about the study. Oh, Bill W. had only changed this. And I'm going back and forth. And we're having book studies and literature studies, but the program is not working because it's all in here. It's not in here. Starting to make some headway, but it isn't. My wife is continuing to drink. We moved to California, where she finally finds sobriety on May 25th, 1983, 8:02 p.m. And things changed. I started to obsess on her food intake, but she also had a food disorder, bulimia. Then I started to obsess on her dress. I never, ever even paid attention to what my wife wore, except to compliment her every now and then. She wore something new and nice. Worst of all, I was obsessing on her spending. She thought shopping is a religious experience, and I disagreed with that notion. I walked up to my sponsor. I said, what's the problem? I said, you know, she stopped drinking, but I am still nuts. And he said, don't you understand? Our disease is obsession, not what they have, but we obsess over behavior. He said, you take something away, you're going to obsess on it. And I noticed that. I said, you know, I told her, I said, Sue, you alcoholics, you give up booze, then it's food. You give up food, addiction to food, then it's smoking. Then you give up your addiction to smoking. Then your next obsession, exercise. Then you move on and on from obsession to obsession. And she said, isn't that wonderful? You moved right along. See, my problem is I go to... And I don't do that now. Women will come up to me and say, oh, do you really do that? You know, I was the kind of person, I'd go, and I'm exaggerating a tad, but I want to make a point. I'd go to dinner with a woman. Let's say she's a number 10 on a scale of 1 to 10. Gorgeous, absolutely. But God help her if she's got a piece of lettuce stuck in a tooth. The woman disappears and a big head of lettuce is right in me. I want to pick a toothpick and scrape it off. I want to take dental floss. You know what I'm talking about? Just as the alcoholic disappeared and all I saw was the booze in front of me, that's how I am. I tend to obsess on... And this occurred, I was in my shower. And I'm taking a shower now, usually all my inspirational thoughts happen in my shower, right? Epiphanies. And I'm standing and staring at my white tile while the shower is in my back. And on the white tile is this little black ant stuck. And all of a sudden, the tile is disappearing and the ant is getting larger because I'm thinking, what kind of protein came out of that ant to cause it to stick? What kind of, and I'm throwing water at it, and it occurred to me how I fixate on the problem instead of the solution. We move in the direction of our dominant thoughts, and that's what I found. I just dominate my thoughts on that ant for some reason. By just figuring out what happened to that ant, by finding the problem there will be my solution. I recognize that's not the case. By trying to figure out what causes the alcoholic drink has not solved my problem. I'm still crazy because I want to drive four cars on the freeway at the same time. The idiot who's not driving fast enough, the guy in the behind me wants to ride in my back seat, and the guy in my blind spot who won't let me cut the guy in front of me. That is my problem, not alcoholism. So now I'm starting to work the steps, and Sue sober in 83, 85, 2 years sober, we start to pop kids, all immaculately conceived. How'd that happen? Justin and Kayla show up, they're now 19, I have twins, boy and a girl, and followed by Corey, who came in 18 months later, and then 5 years later showed up Nathan. And right after the twins were born, I started a new business. Things were going, we bought a new home in California, which is a sticker shock, so we have new kids, newly sober woman, new business, and a new house. And my business after the first year started to go to hell in a handbasket, and I'm occasionally paying my mortgage with my credit card. And I'm just absolutely tired, and I get on my knees and say, God help, and I reach into my wife's book cabinet, pull out this book, and it's a big book of AA, and I close my eyes to just open up whatever shows up, and shows up on step three. And a voice said, you really have not surrendered, you merely submitted. I walked up to my sponsor and said, I quit. And he said, what do you mean? I said, I've been a fraud. I don't walk the talk, I talk the talk. I go to the rooms, people ask me to sponsor them, they tell me how well I share, which they think then that must be I'm working a wonderful program, which I'm not. I'm not necessarily honest in my dealings. I'm not necessarily faithful to my relationships. I'm not loyal to my friendships. I say one thing and don't necessarily follow up with action. I'm going to drop out. I've been a fraud. And I don't know where my sponsor got his logic. He said, if you hadn't been working the program, you would not have come to that understanding. I said, wow, I would never have agreed with that logic, but I was totally torn. And for the first time, I looked at someone and I said, please help me, what do I do? He said, I would go back to the fundamentals. That's my sponsor, he's always into the fundamentals. I said, what's that? He said, I would go to the first step. And don't stand there and say you're powerless over people, places, and institutions unless you truly in your gut believe and understand and accept your powerlessness. And the way I would do it, he said, is read the first step from every source, big book, little book, green book, blue book, whatever book, and then write on the first step as it applies to your situation. And see, with that, he taught me how to define what the problem is. See, I love what Babs from Texas says. She says, every time I get my ducks in a row, they tell me they're not my ducks. So alcoholism has never been my problem. My response to alcoholism has been a problem. I've always found that in the dynamics of my relationships, it's not what the other person does, it's my reaction or response to that thing. I read in this book, he says, A, someone does something, B, it triggers something inside of me, C, I respond. And most people go from A to C, because I'm not looking at it, say, let it begin with me, I don't know what it's causing inside, because I don't want to look at me, I want to look at you. I said, what about step two? He says, step two is rife with options, it's solutions, because he said, you're being restored to sanity. And he says, then your mind is moving away. You've defined the problem, you go to the solutions. What are my options? And that's been a wonderful trip for me because we move in the direction of our dominant thoughts. And I focus on the solution starts to show up in front of me. Step three has been very, very difficult for me. And it clicked in about 1997 and thereafter. About 8 years into my wife's sobriety, she came to the awareness that nasty things had happened to her in her childhood by her father, a priest, and you know what I'm talking about. And that altered the nature of our relationship, so much so that we lost all physical intimacy and strictly had what I would describe as intellectual and spiritual intimacy. We could talk, but we couldn't touch. I walked up to my sponsor and he encouraged me to stick around. We were seeking counseling and all that good stuff. In 1996, my wife finally woke up one day and said, this is over, I want you out of here. I don't want to be married to you anymore. And I channeled a 76-year-old Jewish guy, said, oy vey, I put up with you for 17 years and now you're like me. And then OJ showed, and I got this cleaver going, a program went out the window. I'm angry as hell. I'm just absolutely livid. And I'm going to teach this woman a lesson. I hired a barracuda. I'm paying this guy $250 an hour to just screw her up every which way. I was going to prove to the world she's psychotic, neurotic, incapable of raising children or having a household. She is out. Screw Al-Anon, screw all of this stuff. Program shows up. I'm in front of my attorney. and my sponsor shows up on my shoulder. He's not a psychologist, but apparently he's been with those two other therapists we had talked to about the marriage thing. And he said, so I don't want to lose my kids. See, I used to be a soccer referee, and I would watch kids who came from divorced homes. And the kids had a look in their eyes they did not want to see in my kids, because mom's sitting there with a new boyfriend or dad's sitting there with his new girlfriend, and the kids are torn, and that look in their eye, and I didn't want that in my kids. And my sponsor's voice said, have you asked your wife? He said, check your reality to see if it's really real. See, that happened to me many times. I'm driving, and when I was doing step one, I said, step one is the admitting the existence of a reality. Then my head said, well, it's reality is perceived, so it's the admitting the existence of this perceived reality. And then a voice in my head said, but what if your perceptions are off? Is your reality really a reality? And then I said, boy, that's a marijuana moment. You know, it's been a while. So, back to college. So, but it, you know, it's true. 90% of the time, my perceptions are off. I have to check with something objective to see if it's true. So I call up my wife and I said, I don't want to lose my kids. She said, you're an idiot. We have four kids and I don't want them to myself. And that's when I understood for the first time that God's ways are mysterious. I mean, there's a crisis that has turned out to be a terrific blessing because of the program. I stayed in the same neighborhood, 6 blocks away, now a mile and a half away. We did not have shared custody, we had shared parenting. They could come and go. My divorce cost me less than $700. She still lives in the house that we own together. And I'm not telling you I'm a terrific guy or anything like that. It's just that this program has given me the ability, thank God, to not get so... And I'm not telling you that everything happened in that one cataclysmic moment. I was still nuts. Program gave me tools. I heard a top psychologist on the radio say, write a letter of anger if you're angry at anyone, because anger is what keeps me connected. So I take this letter and put in language that, pardon the expression, that any sailors, we use the stereotype, sailors would have blushed, and writing this thing down. And then I read it to a friend of mine. This happened in Laguna Beach, and if you go north Laguna Beach, if two guys are sitting across from each other, and one's crying, the other one's trying to console him. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm reading, and I tell you, half my anger falls away. Then my friends in AA told me, my buddies who happened to be in AA said, pray for her. Oh God, I got to pray for this woman? So I said, okay. For 30 days, I get on my knees and I pray for her. And I swear to you, this thing is falling, the rock is falling off. And thanks to that process, it took me about a year. But something else happened. I'd worked the fourth step a bunch of times, and my still here, and my therapist, we went to a divorce therapist, for God's sake. It's California for you. How do we divorce amicably? I mean, so my therapist said, don't get involved with any woman. I said, no, I like women, so I'll move to the island of Lesbos, but I won't get involved with them. And she smiled. She said, you'll come across someone, watch it, just give it a year, transition time. So now I walk into my meeting in August, and here's this absolute vision of pulchritude. She's beautiful and she's interested in me, and I'm sitting there and saying, hey, I've transitioned for 7 years. My marriage was dying. Last 2 years it was dead. We're sleeping. So I'm transitioned. So I asked this woman out. And my therapist warned me that the relationship would end in a year. That relationship, again, God works in mysterious ways, because it was the most fantastic thing that could have happened to me at the time. Physically, emotionally, spiritually, intellectually, everything that was lacking in my marriage was given to me multiple fold. A year later it ended and I crashed. It hurt more than I divorced it. I walked up to my sponsor and said, do you have a gun? He said, why? I said, shoot me, I'm in so much pain, I can't take it. Instead, he said, when was the last time you were alone? Couldn't recall. He said, I suggest you lock yourself for a couple of days and do a thorough fourth. I was so distraught, I said, what fourth? Where do I go for the fourth? He said, the book we have is Courage to Change. In that, there's page 345. Page 345 is four questions. I want you to answer that. See, but before that, I'd sort of prepped myself. I'd read some books. I'd read a book called Conversations with God, Part 1. It resonated. Then I read Chuck C's book, A New Pair of Glasses. If you haven't read that, and I'm not suggesting that I'm giving a bibliography, but these are things that helped me. Great treatise on Step 3. There was a book by Zen and the Birds of Appetite by Thomas Merton that I read. Another book on Step 3. And then one the therapist had given me was called How to Be an Adult. So I'm reading this along with my Al-Anon literature. And now, 97, Thanksgiving morning, The phones are off, the pages are off, the TV's off, everything's off, stuck to write. And I'm writing and writing, and anger's pouring out. Who am I? I have no bloody idea. I am whatever you want me to be. And I'm suddenly back to my child going, I'm angry at my dad because he didn't play cricket with me. My father couldn't hold a bat if his life depended on it. My father didn't say he loved me. My father's reassuring love was making sure I had food on my table, clothes on my back, I had school to go to, and all that sort of good stuff. He wasn't from a generation where they hugged. He shook hands. I'm angry at my sisters. I'm angry at everyone. The victim was just pouring out on that paper. And then I take the next question was, what are your values? See, I had no idea what values. I went to Catholic school. Values are honesty, loyalty, fidelity, blah, blah, blah. I said, oh, I have some of those. And I walked up to my sponsor and said, what's a value? He said, do you value children? I said, yes. He said, how do you show that? Do you value friendships? Yes. How do you show that? Do you value business? Yes, I do. How do you show that? Everything had to be backed up by action because I'd lived in a place of concept, not in a place of action. And I'm writing this, and the next question was, what traits of character do you wish to keep about you? Am I writing that? And the last one was, what traits of character do you wish to get rid of? So he conned me into working steps 4, 6, and 7. Saturday morning, after Thursday and Friday, I go see him and I do my 5th. And for the first time I realized that the sinkhole had opened up and the process was dripping from here to here. I heard an AA speaker said, he said, I had my feet firmly planted in midair. And I knew exactly at that moment what he was talking about because I could feel the thud. I could look in the mirror and finally like the person I was looking at and respect the person I was looking at and accept the person I was looking at, because that was the moment for me where all of a sudden I was not judging you as much as I judged you. I did not condemn you as much as I condemned you, because I was starting to accept. Darth Vader showed up and said, welcome to the dark side. See, I denied all the negative about me, pretending this image to be exact. I believed in my own image, and that's what's keeping me in pain. I heard in AA the word disease mentioned very frequently. In Al-Anon, I fought the word disease until one day in my Wednesday night meeting, a woman defined the word disease for me. She said, dis-ease. Insides not matching the outsides. That I could attend to and comprehend and knew what she was talking about, because that's been the bane of my existence for the longest time. I pretended to be something else with you and pretended to be something else with me. The insides were all messed up. And thanks to this program, that has ended. So it's been a wonderful journey for me. Finished up at step 4 and 5. Now I constantly work at step 6 and 7. 8 has been wonderful for me. It's given me the definition of guilt in terms of, as an Al-Anon, I have tremendous amount of guilt for which there is no restitution. It's neurotic guilt that was given to me by my ancestors and my family. Oh, how could you? Oh, how this? And I've recognized there are two types of guilt. One is neurotic, for which there's no restitution. One's real guilt, for which I need to make amends. I have to make amends to institutions today and people today. I'm willing to do it, and I've asked my God to guide me and direct me and give me the opportunity to do it. And they show up in certain ways. So it's been wonderful in that process. I do my meditations when I get a chance. I've developed gossamer wings. I'm healthy. I'm floating around and teasing. So it's still the process in its progress. Thank God this program has a motto that says progress, not perfection. Sometimes I think it's an escapist thing, but on the other hand, it's so gentle. I heard someone say, if you can't let go, hold it gently. And that's really been helpful. I'm going to end up with this little story about what Dennis Miller once said. If you don't know if you're an Al-Anon, the way to find out if you're an Al-Anon is go with the alcoholic to buy bathroom tile. If you have this desire to pick up the tile and rest it against their face to see if it feels comfortable, you just might be a qualified for Al-Anon. Thanks for letting me share.